All right. A call to order the Senate Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection. Colleagues, today is Monday, April 11th, 2011. We're convened for work sessions on several bills, public hearings, as well as an additional round of work sessions. So to map out where I anticipate us going so that you can determine whether or not you need to be here for the whole meeting, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bills 717, 718, and 719. Senator Monroe's request, he would like the insurance administrator to come up and make a few comments about their point of view on those bills, which I'm happy to do. Then we will be rolling over Senate Bill 573 because we're waiting on an amendment. And I will, open up a work session on Senate Bill 634, but only for the purposes of hearing response to previous testimony from Providence Preferred. And then I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 634 because I believe there's some conceptual amendments out there that are still being processed. Then we will switch over to the back page, and I'll open up a work session on 177, 612, 877-667-890 if we have the fiscal. We do not have the fiscal on 890, so we will not be moving that today.
Roll it over.
And roll that. We will roll over 890 for the record. 890 will be rolled over. And I believe we have everything we need for 944. No, we'll be rolling over 944 too. We're still waiting on the paperwork there. Any questions about that? Okay. All right. That being said, why don't I open a work session on Senate Bill 717. Is Administrator Miller here?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to comment on these bills, and if it's okay with you, I'll start in reverse order and start with Senate Bill 719.
I'm afraid not. We have a work session open on 717.
Oh, is it just 717 at this point?
Yeah, I've got to do it each
No problem.
One.
So with regard to 717, just very briefly, this proposal would increase the cost of our rate review process. So the policy question, I think, before the committee really is whether there are benefits that outweigh that cost. I think the bill would result in a likely scenario with carriers where, in an effort to stay under the 7% threshold, carriers may underprice policies for perhaps even a number of years or as long as possible to avoid the public meetings and public hearings that could result, and then come in with a rather significant increase when they absolutely need to, and that increase would be justified because of increases in medical claims costs. So we would have some concerns about the potential rate volatility that may result from that. The insurance division already has the ability to conduct a public hearing on health insurance rate requests, which some of the testimony I think you heard from consumer advocates indicated does give regulators leverage to negotiate lower rates. And in fact, we've used in the past this authority to negotiate lower rates. The 7% is a small enough number. Many health insurance rate requests, I think, will fall above that threshold and trigger the mandatory public meeting. So in some ways, this would take a tool out of our toolbox, if you will. We would no longer be able to convince an insurer who was perhaps requesting a 14% increase to come in with a lower increase because that hearing would be, or that meeting at least, would be triggered in either case. We decide more than 40 rate filings in a given year, so the addition of public meetings and potential public hearings would pose some logistical challenges for us, just because rate requests often come in clusters. And I'll give you an example. In just a two-week period in March, the department received 18 new rate filings. Oregon, as we've talked about in the past, already has a very transparent health insurance rate review process and funds the consumer group OSPERG to offer input on behalf of consumers. All rate filing documents are made public on our website and available as soon as the rate filing is received, which very few states do. We also provide a summary detailing the reasons behind our approval, and we're continuing to add to this process and provide more detailed information about what's driving rates. So the bottom line is this bill really presents some policy questions, I think, for the committee. We can make these changes, but they come with a cost. The cost of additional staff, the cost of intervener's experts, the cost of the Attorney General to represent consumers at hearings, and the cost of insurers to prepare their cases for both the public meeting and the potential public hearing. These would all increase insurers' administrative expenses, and those expenses are generally then just passed on to policyholders. So I think the question for you all is whether there are benefits that outweigh those costs.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Monroe and Senator Boquist, and then we're going to have to move on.
So would this bill then necessarily need to go to Ways and Means?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, I believe it would.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Boquist?
Oh, she answered my question.
Okay.
So, Administrator Miller, you're concerned that having a public meeting is a significant problem for your administration?
It's a significant problem. It just would create some logistical problems. As I mentioned, because we get rate requests often in clusters, it just would present some logistical issues in terms of if we have 18 filings in 2 weeks and we have to have a public meeting on most of those filings within 10 days, it just creates some logistical issues.
And so now, I mean, you have these kind of meetings. They just happen behind closed doors. Is that right?
We don't have public meetings or public hearings on a regular basis.
But my question is, you know, you get together with the actuaries and the staff of the health insurers with your staff and the actuaries and go over the rate filings, but you prefer to have those behind closed doors rather than in a public meeting?
Mr. Chair, on typical rate filings, I do meet with our actuaries and our manager of our actuaries to go over rate filings. Typically, I don't have a meeting with the insurers. Sometimes we do, but not always.
On the United Healthcare filing, on I think it was January 27th, mm-hmm. you had a meeting that you talked about where all the staff and the actuaries of both sides were there. But you talked about Osberg being part of the intervention process, but they weren't at that meeting, were they?
That's correct. They were not.
And what was the rationale for not inviting them?
Mr. Chair, oftentimes when we're looking at rate filings, not oftentimes, occasionally when we're looking at rate filings, if something significant has come up with the United rate filing, they had new information and they wanted to come in and present that information because instead of a 16.8% increase, they wanted less of an increase because of new information. So they wanted to come in and present that, and they did come in and present that information, and Osberg was not included in that meeting.
Yeah, but why didn't you include Osberg? I mean, we awarded $100,000 for them to give input on the filing.
Mr. Chair, the entire rate filing was made public, so they had access to that information. Typically, we don't have Osberg involved in those meetings that we have. I'll talk about, in my comments on Senate Bill 718, I'll talk a little bit about it. At the end of the day, part of the question is, from my perspective, I think it's helpful, particularly when we look at insurers' financial information and decisions that they might be making about their business. There's a policy question, I think, about whether or not you want to have their competitors in the room for those types of conversations. I would argue I think there's benefit in having discussions between the regulator and the insurer where they can be very candid about their business plans and about their finances. We've seen in just the time I've been here, two entities that are essentially one has withdrawn from the market and another has given us notice that they do intend to withdraw from the market simply because they were not able to bring in enough in premiums to pay the cost of doing business, so they're no longer in business. So while rate review is one of the functions we provide, financial regulation is also, in my mind, equally as important. And so as a regulator, we really have to balance those two. And so I do see value in having conversations with insurers where we can have a really candid conversation about their finances, about the impact of the rate filing on their business without having their competitors in the room.
I can appreciate that. The potential for having people intervene in these cases, though, would be a little bit different, right?
I believe so. I'm not exactly certain how the interveners work, but...
Okay. I mean, your points are well taken. I think you, from the beginning, have said everything's fine. You don't need any additional statutory approval. I guess where I see the issues are that I think these issues are too important to small business to have happen behind closed doors, and that in my experience in the PUC world, and perhaps yours too, it's that those who are represented tend to get a better deal, and my point of view, and hopefully the committee will agree, is that that small business should have a seat at that table.
And so, Mr. Chair, I think that's the policy decision before the committee.
Fair enough. So why don't I close the work session on Senate Bill 717, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 718.
Okay.
Administrator Miller.
As I understand it, there are essentially three provisions in Senate Bill 718, so I'll talk about each one in turn. One of the provisions in the bill requires insurers to provide notice to policyholders of any rate filing requesting an average increase of 7% or more and impacting 1,000 or more enrollees. This provision, I think, is very consistent with the work that we've done at the department over the last few years to increase the transparency of our rate review process. We do see a benefit in having insurers direct consumers to all the information available on our website, including the opportunity for consumers to comment on these rate filings. Another provision in the proposed amendment to Senate Bill 718 makes all the communication between the director or any employee of the department with decision-making authority and an insurer who's made a rate filing open to the public. And I think this gets to the issue we were just talking about. I'm not sure exactly what was meant by decision-making authority. As I read that language, I think that could apply to many, if not most, of our staff in terms of people making decisions. And additionally, the requirement is not limited to the time in which we are considering a rate filing. So I think perhaps due to drafting errors, the breadth of this provision could impact the way we do business today. I don't know that that was intended, but it could have significant impacts just in terms of our ability to do our business. More directly, though, to the policy issue, assuming that the provision wasn't intended to be quite so broad, we do believe, as I mentioned, that our ability to have candid conversations with insurers about their financial position or their business plans without having their competitors in the room is beneficial to consumers and assists us in making the best possible decision. So, again, I think that's just the policy decision before the committee is whether or not the loss of that opportunity is outweighed by the desire to have it be open to the public. While our actuaries review the details of a rate filing and ensure that benefits are reasonable in relation to the premiums for a particular product, decisions to require an insurer to take less profit or to dip into surplus, in other words, decisions made based on the consumer or the insurer's overall financial position, those are not really actuarial determinations, and those are not made by our actuaries. Those are made by the administrator. As I mentioned in prior testimony, in recent years, a number of insurers have been losing money in the markets that we regulate. So reducing rate requests required a very detailed understanding of a company's overall financial position. This often involves, for us, conversations internally with our financial regulation staff who know the finances of an insurance company inside and out, and it does occasionally involve conversations with the insurers themselves. When we're considering requiring a company to subsidize a line of business with an unregulated line of business or investment income or surplus, which we've done over the past year or so, we want to make sure that we have the best available information when we're making that decision. And as we discussed previously, rate review is one of the functions we perform. Again, financial regulation is another one. I mentioned we've had two entities leave the market because they were not bringing in enough to support their business. So,
and who were those entities?
One of them was Preferred Health Plan. The other, I don't want to say the name yet because it's not public and I don't think their members know, but Preferred Health Plan is public. We wrote about it in our health report. They exited the market last year.
And how many people did they insure about?
I think in their heyday, I think it was about 3,500, okay. If I recall correctly.
Not a major player.
They were a small entity. And they were a small entity that was really formed for the purposes of competing with some of our major carriers, and unfortunately they weren't able to do so and maintain their business. I'm not aware of any state that prohibits their top insurance officials from communicating with insurers or puts restrictions or requirements on that. But again, I think the policy question before you all is just simply whether the loss of that opportunity for candid conversation is outweighed by the desire for those to be public.
And if I could just put on the record, in case the Court of Appeals is listening, the intention of that is while the rate filing is before you, that there would be no ex parte communication, because in many instances you and the DCBS director are the judge. And if from the testimony that we heard from the Ringo Kirsch case, where they called into question the meeting with the director behind closed doors, and then not quite as in the same league, but I'm concerned that Osprey wasn't invited to the table with United Healthcare. That's where I think this would get to, so that the staff could shoot back and forth, just like in the PUC world, but the people who are actually the final decision makers would be sealed off from lobbying, essentially. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that you might have just answered my question. I just wanted some clarification because it's my understanding that the staff would still be able to the communication.
That's right.
It's just the director.
Yeah. If the bill were amended to limit it that way, I think.
Well, it says all communications between the director or any employee of the department with decision-making authority.
Right.
So I think decision-making authority would seem to me to be on its face to say whether or not it's approved, disapproved, or modified, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chair, that's not the way I would read the bill. We have staff who make decisions on a number. I'll give you just an example on rate filings in particular. We have support staff who make decisions about whether or not the filing is complete, which is a pretty major decision because if it's not deemed complete, it doesn't get posted and doesn't start the 30 days. I would argue that that's a decision, and it doesn't. It's not a decision about whether we're approved it, but it is a decision on the rate filing. So I'm just concerned that the language may be broader than what was intended.
Okay, fair enough. Let's see, anything else you want to say on 7-1?
Finally, I think there's one other provision that requires the department to develop a detailed rationale for our approval explaining how the increase meets specific statutory requirements. And the department does currently draft a summary written in plain language to try to help explain to consumers the reasons behind our approval. With additional resources, we could certainly craft a more detailed summary. Again, I think that's just a policy call for this body in terms of the goals you have for that document.
All right. Questions? Senator George.
Based on what the chair was just asking you about, a decision maker, do you see a way we could craft some amendments to make it very selective? What we're trying to do is create, you know, basically the few people that actually make the final determination. How would you tighten that language up so it would just apply to the selected few that actually make the final determination?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think that would be pretty easy if you just limited it. If you wanted to limit it to the director and the administrator, I think that would be, if that's the intent, in our previous conversations, that was my understanding of the intent, I think that would be very easy to draft.
And then we would also need to put in something
limiting it to the
when the rate filing is actually in place.
Right.
Because I don't mind talking with whoever, but once it's before you, it seems that you should seal off since
I think
you
it would
and
be pretty
DCBS.
Easy to limit that as well.
The director or the judge. Okay, Senator Monroe, and then we're going to have to move on.
Yeah, I concur with Senator George that language needs to be tightened up. The question is then, is there a fiscal on this bill, assuming a little bit of tightening language, or is this something that would have to go to Ways and Means or something that we could move straight out of this committee?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, I don't think there was any fiscal attached to the communication language. I think the fiscal relates to drafting more in detail decision summaries that are more kind of legal documents. So I believe there would still be a fiscal. I haven't seen what LFO has come up with, but I believe there would still be a fiscal associated with that.
I serve on Ways and Means, but I'm always looking for ways of avoiding it when possible. If we can pass good legislation that doesn't have to go to Ways and Means, I would prefer that.
And there is another amendment that we're still waiting on 718. So it looks like we're going to have to amend that bill again. So we've got a little bit of time. Any other questions on 718? All right. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 718 and open a work session on Senate Bill 719.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following the public hearing on Senate Bill 719, I did send a letter to the committee to provide some clarification on the Insurance Division's enforcement powers and practices, so I won't go through all of that. I'll just make a couple of points. The trade practices provision of the Insurance Code are fairly comprehensive and include broad consumer protections that are very similar to those contained in the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. I mentioned in my letter that the department uses its significant authority and broad enforcement powers under the law to penalize those who violate the insurance code. Since 2010, the department has initiated enforcement actions that have resulted in the levying of tens of thousands of dollars in fines against insurers. During all of 2010 and the first 3 months of 2011, the department collected over $368,000 in fines from actions against insurance companies and producers. Having said that, though, our primary focus is to make consumers whole when they're harmed by violations of the insurance code and to ensure compliance going forward. From 2008 to 2010, our staff recovered more than $22 million for consumers. And recoveries like these are really very much an untold story because they're not part of our enforcement action, but it is where we spend a significant amount of time and staff resources. Although the department does have strong enforcement powers, we're not always able to provide the relief requested by consumers. The department, like I think most, if not all, agencies, does not have the kind of equitable powers typically reserved for the courts. So as such, the department cannot require an insurance company, for example, to reinstate an individual Medicare supplement policy, and under the circumstances I think described at the hearing, to require a company to pay a claim under such a policy no longer in effect. Given that the UTPA closely tracks the authority we have under the insurance code, it's not clear to me how bringing insurance under the UTPA would fix the issues that were discussed at the hearing. Senate Bill 719's creation of a dual system of state regulation for insurance does raise some concerns. If you have two regulators who both have authority to address violations of the insurance code, under Senate Bill 719, the two regulators could take actions that are not consistent with one another. And then I think you have an issue where you have a heavily regulated industry who has to pick which regulator they want to follow. And finally, I think it's important to note that no one provided testimony at the public hearing explaining the value of adding a second regulator. I think rather the proponents of Senate Bill 719 clearly felt that the prevailing plaintiff attorney's fees provision in the UTPA would remedy their concerns. And so if the legislature agrees with the proponents on that, it could add such a provision to the insurance code instead of creating a dual system of regulation. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you for your point of view.
Thank you very much.
One thing, I know, is it all right if I address something on 717, even though we're in work session?
Just close it and reopen 717.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, did you want me to talk about another amendment?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, as long as we've got the work session open. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to also put on the record that I've requested an amendment that would delete line 41 of page 8 of 719, which is the part that makes a violation of the Unfair Claim Settlement Practices Act a UTPA violation. So it would retain the language that removes the insurance exclusion so that insurance would still be included in the definition of real estate goods and services. And the reason I did that is because I think it's analogous to the bill that we passed last February where we removed the credit and exemption exclusion. But we didn't at that time add a violation of any of the other regulatory statutes was a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. So I think that this is, in that condition as amended, would be more in line with that, which would mean that just basically all the businesses in the state are under our state's primary consumer protection statute.
Thank you
for letting me explain that.
Thank you. And it's my understanding when we brought banks and other financial institutions under the UTPA last time, there was no fiscal impact to that. According to what I was told, I haven't actually looked at it myself.
I don't think there is.
So that being said, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 719. I want to reopen the work session on Senate Bill 717, and I don't think we've received the fiscal back or even a draft of it, but one thing that struck me is that in the previous session, we had House Bill 3145A, which we adopted a lot of the language or the principles into 717, and I looked back and that had a minimal fiscal impact. So I'd be surprised if your agency now said the bill, you know, this new bill that basically has in many ways less onerous provisions because it doesn't use the contested case hearing in quite the same way, would have a more significant impact fiscally.
For Senate Bill 717?
Yeah. But anyway, I just wanted to get that on the record.
I know LFO has our fiscals and they've had them for today is Monday. I think they had them last week. I believe they had them on Wednesday of last week. So they've been in from our perspective.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, mm-hmm. Administrator Miller. Let's close the work session on Senate Bill 717. And we're rolling over Senate Bill 573, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 634 for the purposes of allowing a Providence Preferred to give some testimony on the topic.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, Dave Fiskum here for Providence Health and Services. thank you for a brief opportunity to try to correct the record that at least we felt was left with some inaccurate perceptions last week when Senate Bill 634 was first heard by your committee. I should tell you that I have talked with my colleagues from the Oregon Medical Association, and I do not believe their intent was to leave an inaccurate impression, but as a listener that day, my sense was that the impressions were in fact inaccurate. Whatever the motivation, I wanted to have this chance to correct the record. With me to my right is Allison Miller, the PPO product manager for Providence Preferred. She has held this position for 14 years, and she is ready to provide a few comments to you for the record as well. Mr. Chair, will then be willing to answer your questions. So thank you for your courtesy.
Ms. Miller, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Allison Miller, and I'm the PPO product manager for Providence Health Plans, and I manage the Providence Preferred Network Payer Relationships. I'm here today to clarify the record in regards to Providence's role regarding silent PPO activity, as was submitted to testimony on April 6th. I provided the committee with a letter with more detailed testimony, but I would like to highlight a couple of key points. Providence Preferred does not allow silent PPO activity. Payers who contract with us are required to have our logo on the member's identification card. Any discounts taken on a Providence Preferred member should be that provider's contracted rate with Providence Preferred following our mutual contract. We do not share provider data information, or more importantly, fee schedules with entities that do not have a contractual relationship with us, and we do not accept funds for sharing provider information with non-contracted entities. As stated in my letter, many of the problems mentioned are legitimate payment errors and not the product of silent PPOs we have engaged in, and can be resolved by contacting our office for resolution. We are a provider-owned preferred provider organization, and one of our core business functions is to help our contracted providers with any issues or concerns they encounter with claims, with either claims payment discrepancies or identification in regards to our members. We would like to encourage our providers to contact us, and we are more than willing to help. Thank you for the opportunity to address these issues, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Miller, for clarifying that. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 634. And I will...
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 177. Patrick, you want to tee it up for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We heard this bill on March 9th. This bill is the one that reduces the required frequency of meetings of credit union boards of directors, allows credit unions to appoint a chief credit officer in lieu of a credit committee. It permits credit unions to make loans under certain conditions to the president or chief executive. At the time, we had considered there were some amendments that were discussed. We have provided for you today, the members, three amendments. They're in your packet. We have the fiscal and revenue statements for all three amendments. The Dash 2 amendment deletes provisions that expressly permit credit unions to make employee discount loans available to the management team and directors. It adds reporting requirements for loans to senior managers and directors, prohibits directors and senior managers from participating in approval of or disbursement of loans in which they have direct or indirect interest. The Dash 4 amendment allows credit unions that are chartered under Oregon law to merge with credit unions chartered under laws of another state in the same manner as mergers between credit unions chartered under Oregon law currently. And the Dash 8 amendment establishes a procedure for credit union members that are opposed to a merger proposal to provide information to fellow members regarding their views about the merger proposal. As I indicated, all three amendments we have received statements of no fiscal impact and no revenue impact, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Patrick. And if I could just express my appreciation to the Credit Union Association for working with me on the Dash 4s and the Dash 8s, just to put on the record what the issue was with the Dash 4s. A legislative council had interpreted when I asked them to do some research for me regarding the First Tech merger with I believe, Addison in California, a particular section of the Credit Union Act that seemed, from LC's perspective, to indicate that the default would be to approve a merger, and that unless you had a very, very good reason, you had to approve. And I think that was just a needed some clarification. The Credit Union Association didn't read the bill that way as LC did, so they were willing to work on this amendment, the dash 4, in order to clarify that. And my understanding, and they're in the back of the room, and I can tell by their heads nodding that they're okay with bringing this into the bill. The dash 8 dealt with the issue that we brought up when we first heard this, and again, I appreciate the Credit Union Association for working with us on this, which is I have some concerns that there might not be a way for dissenters of a merger to weigh in amongst the membership. And they worked diligently with me on the Dash 8, and we came to an agreement on a way that people could dissent, get their views to the other members. Yet if they were out of bounds and impugn the motives of the board or otherwise were out of line, the board could agree that this was not an appropriate dissenting point of view. And then finally, through that amendment in the Dash 8, it would allow that member to appeal to DCBS in order to get a second opinion. So I really do appreciate the work on that. I know I just appreciate the good faith effort. I'll just leave it at that. It was a lot of work. And so that being said, Senator George, do you want to move the dash 2s, dash 4s, and dash 8s?
Everybody's agreed on all of them. Great.
Are we in agreement on the
2s? And we are in work session.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 177.
Senator George has moved the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 177. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved. Senator George.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 177.
Senator George moves the dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 177. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So moved. Senator George.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 177.
Senator George has moved the dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 177. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none. So ordered. Senator George.
And this is going to the floor, correct?
Yep. We have the paperwork. We're ready.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 177 as amended by the Dash 2, the Dash 4, and the Dash 8 amendments to the floor with the DuPass recommendation.
Senator George has moved Senate Bill 177 as amended to the floor with the DuPass recommendation. Any discussion? Could you please call the roll?
Senator
Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Oquist?
Aye.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair Sheehan?
Aye. Motion passes. Senator George, would you like to carry that on the floor? Senator George will carry it on the floor. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 177 and open a work session on Senate Bill 612. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 612, we heard on March 7th. This measure requires construction labor contractors to be licensed by the Boley Commissioner, establishes licensure requirements, fees, and exceptions, directs a commissioner to administer and enforce licensing and regulatory requirements and to adopt rules. It establishes grounds for denying, suspending, and revoking such licenses, specifies the duties of construction labor contractors, authorizes the commissioner to assess civil penalties for violations, prohibits certain actions and discrimination against employees, creates a cause of action against persons acting as a construction labor contractor without a license, and against persons using an unlicensed contractor. The measure has an emergency clause and would take effect upon passage. We have also the Dash 1 amendment, which is in your packet, for which we have received a fiscal impact statement and no revenue impact statement. The Dash 1s exempt labor unions and local joint apprenticeship committees from application of the measure. It removes the $100 and $250 maximum fee for construction labor contractor licenses and changes the operative date to July 1st, 2013. Mr. Chair.
Okay. And if I recall, we didn't have any testimony in opposition for this, and we have the fiscal. So I think we're ready to go. Are you comfortable with this?
No.
Okay.
Should I need to make a motion?
Yeah.
You said there was a fiscal.
Hold on 1 second.
It's in the package.
So both
yeah. It's indeterminate.
It's indeterminate.
Whatever
that means.
That's
not
good. Indeterminate.
Yeah, why don't we go ahead and adopt the Dash 1s.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 612.
Senator Bonamici has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 612. Is there any discussion? Any objection?
Mr. Chair, I move...
Hold on. Wait for a second. I think I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 612. And
okay. I was looking for the fiscal. That's what I was missing.
Okay. All right. Okay. So we may come back to this, to 612 this today. I will open a work session on Senate Bill 667. Okay. And we do have the dash twos, though, right? Okay. So as long as I've got the work session open, we've got a dash two amendment to 667, and if I think what my intention would be to move that into 667 now. My understanding is, and I think is ODOT's in the room, is that they still have some concerns, but they're working in good faith with the parties, and you're okay with this bill moving forward at this time. But we don't have the fiscal yet, so why don't we go ahead and move the dash twos. Senator George, you feel comfortable doing that?
Yeah.
Let's move the dash twos into Senate Bill 667.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 667, dated April 6th.
Okay. Senator George has moved the dash two amendments into Senate Bill 667. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so moved. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 667. We'll roll this over until we have the paperwork. And okay. And I will.
Do we have the paperwork on either?
We do not. We haven't.
Okay. Okay. Why don't we? I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 890. Patrick, you want to tee us up to where we are?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 890, we heard on April 4th, is a measure that requires contracting agencies to include a condition in public contracts under which a contractor must pay subcontractors in a timely fashion a risk action for damages or the relief from the contracting agency or disqualification from future public contracts. We have been provided with two amendments. The Dash 3 amendment requires contracting agency provided for the first-tier contractor with a standard form to use. It specifies that changes to the form may not be used for as a basis for delaying, withholding, or denying payment. It allows the contractor to change a form or regular administrative procedures used to process payments if notice is provided to subcontractor. It provides for graduated remedies, including revocation of prequalification and debarment. It provides that making payments for 5 years results in subsequent failure to do so being treated as a first violation. The Dash 5 amendment, also in your packet, deletes references to ORS 279B and amendments to 279B-220 and amends 279C.570 to clarify duties of contracting agencies and prompt payment of contractors and prompt payment of subcontractors and providing for requirement for elimination and payment of retainage, Mr. Chair.
All right. So just so that everybody knows clearly what we've done here, there was an issue about retainage that is closely associated with the prompt payment, and the Dash 5 amendment basically brings that issue into this bill. Since we don't have the fiscal for this, we're not ready to move it today, so I think I'll hold off on moving the amendments just to make sure that we're moving the right ones. So I will close the work session on Senate Bill 890.
Mr. Chair, if I can make a comment.
Yes,
Senator George. We have a hearing, and I'm clearly interested in the issue because of the fact that I don't like people getting money from the state and then shorting their contractors. We did talk with AGC and others and try to get them together to see if they couldn't come up with some workable deal on this cash flow issue. And I'm hoping that that's going on, that we're not going to be stuck here in a situation where amendments are going forward without at least an attempt to find a negotiation on that. So.
Yeah, no, I would encourage, I do anticipate moving it, so if AGC wants to bring these bills more to their liking, I would encourage them to do so. So my understanding is that NECA, the independent electricians, the associated building contractors, and the Oregon building trades were all supportive of 890 in testimony. All right, I've already closed the work session on that, and then we're going to roll over Senate Bill 944. Again, we may come back to Senate Bill 612 later in the hearing. Just want to.
Did you want to adopt the amendments to 944?
Okay, we have the final amendments back.
We do have.
Okay. Are we in work session now?
I would reopen it just to make sure.
I'll reopen a work session on Senate Bill 944 for the purposes of putting in the amendments. Patrick, could you tee up the amendments for me?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 944 prohibits the Liquor Control Commission from imposing minimum amount requirements for liquor purchases. We heard it on March 21st. The -3 amendment, which was worked out with the Liquor Control Commission, specifies that single container purchases must be of items of value of $30 or greater. The measure authorizes, the amendments authorize the commission to annually adjust the price threshold according to the Consumer Price Index in the Portland, Salem, Oregon, Washington region. The measure also specifies that single unit purchases must be of a brand available through a U.S. distributor that does not require the commission to acquire more than one case in a single transaction and is not regularly stocked by the commission. And the measure with the amendment would require that such special orders be for a 750 milliliter container if the product is available in that size, Mr. Chair.
All right. And OLCC and the proponent of this bill are... Is OLCC in the room? Anyone from OLCC?
Those are their amendments.
Their amendments, okay, good. So,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
So then OLCC was opposed to this bill. They're no longer opposed to this bill if we adopt this amendment?
Actually, I think they were supportive of the bill. They had an amendment that would have brought the limit down to, what, $30 and...
I'm thinking of a different bill.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, this is an easy OLCC bill. So we're still in work session. Senator George?
Mr. Chair, -3 amendments, correct?
The -3, right?
Yep. Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the -3 amendments to Senate Bill 944, dated April 8th.
Senator George moves the -3 amendments to Senate Bill 944. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, real quickly.
Yep.
I mentioned this in the public hearing, and I urge the OLCC to make it even more generous to the small operators, because it's going to be hard to come back and revisit this with a separate bill, but I'll support these amendments, although I still think they're being pretty strict on these small, especially operators, since they only have one entity to buy their goods.
Okay.
So...
So you're good with the amendments. All right, so have you moved the amendment?
Yep.
Okay, Senator George has moved the -3 amendments to Senate Bill 944. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 944, and we will roll that over. All right.
We're up to the work session.
Yep. Okay, so I will. Okay. I'll open a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 908. And if the elected officials who are going to testify on SCR 9, if they could please be identified now and work their way down, I think this is only going to take a moment or two. Hopefully. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Frank Garcia, Office of the Governor, Affirmative Action, Diversity and Inclusion, Chair Senator Chiles, and Vice Chair Senator George, members of the committee. It's an honor to be here to talk a little bit about this proposed name change to Director for Diversity and Inclusion, as opposed to keep it as Affirmative Action Director. And basically, Diversity and Inclusion builds on the legacy of suffrage and civil rights and affirmative action, terminology that now advances that spirit into the 21st century marketplace based on organizational development, helping organizations thrive, problem solving. It's based on Title VI of civil rights, which focused on non-discrimination in federally assisted programs. In essence, over time, it's become an issue focusing on service delivery. And so ultimately, diversity inclusion is value added. It helps an organization thrive. It looks at all of the unique talents and gifts and skill sets that the workforce comprises of and leverages it to move forward. Affirmative action is terminology that's based also on civil rights and suffrage, but has become codified in our administrative processes today and has become accountability, compliance, CEO, all those things that we do wonderfully. But again, it gets usurped by us versus them. And doesn't allow for buy-in and get true ownership. Diversity and inclusion is basically terminology that is appropriate for where we're at today in society, and just continues to advance the spirit of civil rights in a way that's proactive and one that's value-added. That's all I have to say.
Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, members of the committee, thank you for listening to our testimony today. I just wanted to be here in support of the name change in Senate Bill 908. Also, very similar to Mr. Garcia in that bringing forward a title that is certainly more 21st century oriented and also ties stronger to our economic development practices in our state. And so I'm just here to say I'm very supportive of the bill and here if you have any questions.
Great. We are pleased to see you in your new positions. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Okay, we have an amendment on this.
The thing, Mr. Chair, we do have the Dash 1 amendment. The Dash 1 amendment was provided by the Governor's Office. It removes the name change for the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business and moves maintaining the Oregon Opportunity Register and Clearinghouse from the duties of the Office for Minority Women and Emerging Small Business, the duties of the Director of Economic and Business Equity.
That's correct, Chair. So we have the Dash 1s. We do not have a fiscal, so we'll be carrying this one over as well. Senator George, do you feel comfortable moving the Dash 1?
Sure. Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment.
Wait. My apologies. Let me close the public hearing on Senate Bill 908 and open a work session on Senate Bill 908.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 908 dated March 21st.
Senator George has moved the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 908. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And I
thank
will
you so much.
Close
thanks
the work session on Senate Bill 908, and I will open a public hearing on SCR 9. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Concurrent Resolution 9 memorializes Jane Minthorn, 1936 to 2010. We have received a notice of no expenditure impact and a notice of no revenue impact, so we have all the paperwork necessary to take action on the bill today, Mr. Chair.
All right. Who do we have signed up? We have Secretary of State. Brown, please come forward.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Is Senator Nelson here yet? Also? No. Fire away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Kate Brown, currently Oregon's 24th Secretary of State, and I'm honored to testify here in support of SCR 9, which will recognize Jay Minthorn's many years of service to the state of Oregon and to the 9 federally recognized tribes in Oregon. I first met Jay when he came to the commission. I've been serving on the commission in my role as a House member since 1991. I believe Jay came in 1995. He was an exemplary public advocate with boundless curiosity, poise, and a brilliant smile. He made sure each and every sovereign tribe was treated with respect and dignity. And for anyone who works with the tribe knows, each tribe is its own nation, and this was quite a feat for him to accomplish. He was a fierce advocate for the passage of Senate Bill 770, which required state agencies to consult with Oregon's 9 federally recognized tribes, and he enjoyed his role as vice chair and then chair of the commission. We believe he became chair of the commission in 2001. He worked really hard to bring the tribes together in his role as leader of the Commission on Indian Services. Jay made friends instantly and would always have the most phenomenal stories to tell about people that he met, sometimes only for a few moments. He was a great listener and a stickler for detail. He also had a really fabulous memory. The funny thing was, when we first met, I was Representative Brown. And even when I went to the state Senate, I was still Representative Brown. And I think even in my role as Secretary of State, I was still Representative Brown. And I think to him, I will always be Representative Brown. Sadly, Oregon its sovereign nations, and his family lost Jay Minthorne this past November. He was truly one of Oregon's gems. He leaves behind his children and family, who he cherished deeply. It's my honor to urge you all to vote in support of SCR 9. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Secretary of State Brown.
Questions?
All right. Why don't we bring up Leo Stewart while we're waiting for Senator Nelson.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman, Chairs Shields, and the members of the committee. The Confederated Tribes of Umatilla Reservation would like to express our support and urge your committee favorably consideration of Senate Concurrent Resolution 9. When Jay Minthorne passed away in November, the CTUIR lost a valuable leader, teacher, and a tireless advocate for tribal rights. A man who would stand up without hesitation to protect our rights and resources. In his 20 years of service on the Board of Trustees, Jay would work cooperatively with local, private, state, and federal partners in the finest model of leadership by example. Again, I would like some of his family's here today in support, and some of the family that couldn't make it, Send their support too. They called me as I was coming down. Again, the CTR greatly appreciates the efforts of the sponsor of SCR 9 in recognition by the Oregon State Legislature of work of Atwai J. Raleigh Minthorne, Shekhai Chachal. And his name was White Badger. Your hearing of SCR 9 at this time comes near a day of great pride for Jay, the Earth Day of April 22nd, also his birthday. And I would thank you. I thank you for this opportunity to. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for coming, bringing this forward. Questions?
Any questions?
No, thank you very much, Senator Nelson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from District 29, and happy to bring this bill before you. Jay was a great person. I've known him since the 1940s. I was the bat boy, and he's about my brother's age, and so I've known him for a long time. You've heard all the good things that he's done. Just a great person, and I could go on and on about that, but I know you guys are kind of short for time, and you've heard some really great things. Secretary of State Brown, as you know, he was involved in the Indian Commission for years and years, and he appeared in front of the Senate on several occasions, leading the religious exercises, and he was the drummer, and I mean, it's just a great person, and I really appreciate the fact that you guys take time to hear this bill and honor him.
Happy to do it, Senator. Questions? I also see that there are a lot of people here for this SCR, and we appreciate all of you being here to push forward this in memoriam for Jay Minthorne. He sounds like an incredible human being. Thank you. All right. Is this ready to go? I will close the public hearing on SCR 9 and open a work session on SCR 9.
Mr. Chair, I move SCR 9 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved SCR 9 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Debbie, could you call the roll, please?
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Boquist?
Aye.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
And Chair Shields.
Aye. Motion passes. And how about we have Senator Nelson carried on the floor?
All right,
that'd be good. And I will close the work session on SCR 9 and open a public hearing on SB 679. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 679 prohibits retailers from selling, leasing, offering for sale or lease, or otherwise distributing cellular telephones unless the device and its packaging bear specified labels. It designates violation of the measure an unlawful trade practice and has an operative date of July 1st, 2012. We currently do not have a fiscal impact statement, but we have in your packet been provided with testimony from several individuals, including Bob Stevenson, Santa McDonough, Horst Eager, and Henry Lai, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And do we have the sign-up sheet?
Oh, yeah. It's coming out right now, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, can we bring up, let's bring up David Morrison. And then, David, I'll let you direct us on how the proponents would like to proceed. I think there's someone who wants to testify by phone, is that right?
Yeah, David Carpenter will testify by phone.
Okay.
And there's other material that has been forwarded to your office from other scientists and medical people. I hope that some of that can be read as well.
It'll become part of the record. We're not going to have time to read it into the record.
Okay.
But fire away. And
please
identify.
I'd like to thank you all.
Could you identify yourself formally for the committee?
Oh, my name's David Morrison, and I wanted to thank you for initiating this bill. It's long overdue. Senate Bill 679 is not a bill about brain cancer and cell phones. It's a bill about good policy and the public's right to know what we now know about the safety of cell phone use. The science is sound. Human and animal studies confirm biological effects from exposure to radiation from cell phones. Studies funded by the CTIA itself found many biological effects from cell phone radiation. The Supreme Court has established that there is a controversy with cell phone use and brain cancer in their summary of the Dahlgren case from 2010. This is a bill that by all moral and scientific and intuitive standards is reflective of good policy and should sail through the Senate and House with no problem, but the problem is industry pushback. This is a bill that, if passed, will absolutely save lives and do what the federal government is unwilling to do. I believe that it's your moral and perhaps legal duty to vote yes on this right-to-know bill, so consumers have the information to make informed choices. The CTIA has been visiting the Senate, leaving material with you that is outdated, contradictory, full of lies, omissions, and is based on antiquated statements from organizations that have long since lost their credibility by colluding with industry. All of the quoted organizations are or have been investigated for fraud, and collusion with industry. One thing I did not see in the CTIA material, however, was the results of the Dr. George Carlos studies funded by the CTA in the 1990s. In 1993, the CTIA funded studies with Dr. George Carlos that, when completed in 1999, reported a doubling of brain cancer, micronuclei in the blood, which is a marker for the development of cancer, and a correlation with brain tumors on the same side of the head that the cell phone was held. All of the studies were peer-reviewed and made available to the FDA and the FCC and other government agencies, but never became part of the public policy process. None of this information can be found on the FDA website. We have a problem here with federal oversight. Currently, there is a law against the lawsuit against the FDA filed by the Environmental Health Trust for refusing to release documents in a Freedom of Information request relating to potential collusion between the telecommunications industry and the FCC. We need this bill. This is a profound and historic piece of legislation. We need the state government to act on behalf of its citizens. In October 2010, Motorola began adding brain cancer warnings to the manuals supplied with cell phones. They advise keeping the BlackBerry an inch away from the body, especially teenagers and pregnant women. They refer to animal studies that suggest low levels of radio frequency could accelerate cancer development in lab animals. They also mention an association found between mobile phone users and the formation of gliomas, a rare form of brain cancer, etc., etc. The recent additions to the Motorola literature, the thousands of scientific studies, the suppressed CTIA-funded studies of the 1990s, asking for a label on the packaging that informs customers of an established controversy regarding the safety of cell phones is basic, is vital, and is justified. We want to see the information on the packaging and not lost within the fine print. Consumers have a right to know. If this fails, the big losers are our children and grandchildren, who, if under 20, have a 480% higher chance of brain tumor development, which was established by a Swedish study by Lennart Hardell, than adults because their bodies are still developing in their longer cumulative life exposure levels. Many scientists, doctors, foresee a crisis that will eclipse tobacco and asbestos combined, with 4 billion cell phone users worldwide. The other big loser is the state, who will be paying out billions of dollars in health care costs related to cell phone use. If this bill passes, it will alert other agencies like the Department of Education that we need to be teaching our children safer cell phone use as we teach about tobacco, alcohol, and drugs. On behalf of our children, as well as your conscience, please vote yes on this bill. I'd also like to request a postponement on the voting of this issue until the 18th due to the short notice of the hearing and that it made it difficult for us to assemble witnesses and meet with other legislators if possible.
I appreciate that. I don't think we'll be able to do that, but thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Do you want me to call up the other people as proponents, or would you prefer to call somebody in by phone first?
No, I'd like to have the people who are here.
Yeah, okay. Can we bring up...
are you not allowing questions?
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Senator.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Morrison, for your question. I wonder if you have... I've been doing consumer protection for a long time, and I wonder if you have any studies that show the actual connection between a warning label and consumer behavior.
Warning label and
consumer behavior. Does a warning label really change consumer behavior, or are education efforts just as important?
I don't have studies on that, but you know, we're looking at the same type of issue here as tobacco. The information is there, and as the information becomes available, it's proliferated into other areas, and of course, you know, mothers will, before they buy a cell phone for their, you know, 12-year-old daughter who, you know, who has a 50% more deeper exposure into the brain with radiation, you know, she might actually look at them. I'm sure that, you know, some parents who have no idea, most people just have no idea about this. So it will bring it to the forefront and allow people to make choices for themselves.
Mr. Chair, can I ask one more question? Yeah. And then I'm interested because I see your names on the bill. Do you have a particular background in this, a scientific background, medical background?
No, it's a personal issue. My daughter was going to a school that put a cell phone tower right in the middle of the school, and I began doing research on the issue, and the more research that I did, the more astonishing the science is that's basically being buried and by our media and industry.
Thank you.
Senator George.
Just kind of a question for you and then the other proponents of the bill as they come up. Here's the question for you is that I think a lot of people look at all the electronics that we have. There's even a common joke in the United States, what'd you do? Did you grow up under power lines? You know, implying that there's a certain recognition that when we have electronic devices, they may have some kind of negative health impact. And so the question is this isn't like tobacco where people are making a choice to smoke, for instance, and they need to be warned. This is something that pretty much everybody, probably the penetration of all electronic devices is hitting close to 100%. at least in the high 90s, of Americans who are using electronic devices. Seems more like to me that it'd be akin to like automobiles. We don't have a disclaimer that goes on every automobile. You may be hurt, harmed, or killed in an automobile accident when you buy this product. Because there's a certain recognition that there are certain things that are outside of our control when we use some type of modern technology. So give me an idea of why it would be better to pursue a warning label than it would just a public education campaign.
Well, I think both are very important, actually. But are you, are you proposing one over the other? Or, I mean, I think both are important. But, this can't really be compared to an automobile that, when it's sitting there or when you're driving, it has a benign, you're in control of the automobile. This is a radiation-emitting device that, has specific warnings within now, as of October 2010, has specific warnings within the manuals that talk about brain cancer and other things. We want it on the package. We want it rather than lost in the fine print. And I can't imagine anything wrong with that. All of the things that you talked about do have some effect. All electronic devices do have an effect on we're electrical systems, our bodies are electrical systems. So there is a intermingling and a conflict of different electrical systems as they enter our body. It's the difference, of the choice to smoke, as like you're saying, most people have cell phones now, so they need the information that there is safer cell phone use, especially our kids.
Thank you very much for your testimony, David. Can we bring up Sean? yes, Sean. And Mary Callahan, please. Welcome to the committee.
Senator Shields, thank you. May it please the committee, my name is Sean Abril. I'm an attorney in Portland, Oregon. My focus of my practice is electromagnetic radiation litigation. First, I want to thank Senator Shields for meeting with me and David Morrison and David Cracky with the Oregon Brain Injury Association back in September and initially ultimately sponsoring this very important bill. Just a few weeks ago, Oregon's House of Representatives continued Oregon's long history of putting forth the very first bill in the country that will ban shark fin meat sales in the state of Oregon. I am encouraged that Oregon will also take the very first steps to providing warning labels on cell phones in order to protect Oregonians, including pregnant women and unborn children. Why is this bill so important? As a father of a young girl, one of the reasons is to protect our children and future generations. In fact, there's not one safety level for microwave radiation for children, not one. This is because children do not have our immune systems. They are not developed. Their bones are soft. The microwaves penetrate very easily. Inside their bones, they are producing stem cells, which make their immune systems and all other parts of their bodies. Their skulls are thin. As well, children absorb more radiation than adults because they are smaller near the wavelength of cellular signals. They act like antennas. There is not a single safety level for microwave radiation for children, not one. We believe the problem with children is even more serious with young girls, and this is because microwaves can damage the genetic structure in their ovaries. Girls are born with all the eggs they need in their ovaries at birth. They are immature eggs, basically 200 in each. Because microwaves are genotoxic, there's a possibility that microwaves can affect the genetic structure within the eggs. Now, the problem here is that mitochondrial DNA, the genes inside the ovaries, is irreparable once it's damaged. So if you have a little girl who damages this mechanism through this mechanism, the genetic structure in one of her eggs, and she has a daughter, that daughter will carry that genetic problem because it's irreparable. And her daughter will carry that genetic problem because it's irreparable. And every female forever in that line will carry that genetic problem because it's irreparable. So I also wish to point out that cell phone companies already provide a warning label against the harmful effects of microwaves. However, the warning label is buried deep inside of instructions where no consumer will look. By placing the warning label on the phone itself will actually and fairly warn Oregon's consumers so they are able to make informed decisions when purchasing and using a cell phone. Finally, I wish to quote Dr. David Carpenter, who I believe is going to speak here via telephone, who believes that we will face an epidemic of cancers in the future resulting from uncontrolled use of cell phones and increased pollution exposure to Wi-Fi and other wireless devices. This is important to all of us, and especially children, that we restrict our use of cell phones and limit our exposure to background levels of Wi-Fi.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Welcome to the committee.
Hello. Is that my turn?
Your turn.
All right. Thank you, Senator Shields, Chairman, and members of the committee. I'm here to testify on behalf of the cell phone labeling bill on a different topic entirely. Excuse me?
Say your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Mary Callahan, and I'm a local business consultant that I've been working in the industry regionally and nationally for about 18 to 20 years as a small business startup consultant. So as a consultant for small business startups and development in the regional, national, real estate investment trust world, I ask you to picture every shopping mall visit you've made. You will remember that in every shopping mall in America is home to many cell phone kiosks selling contract and renewal packages for Verizon, T-Mobile, AT&T, etc. Not only is each package sold with built-in cell accessories like car chargers and belt clips and more, but virtually every telecom customer is likely to end up at the local cell accessories cart or small electronics store. Probably you or someone in your family has done so. These are my clients. This is a massive market. This includes cell phone covers in every color and style, from Transformers or Harley Davidson to My Little Kitty. They have pouches and belt clips, cell phone charms, jewelry, bedazzling kits. They have headsets by Jabra, Plantronics, and Skullcandy. They have hands-free adapters, batteries and boosters, chargers and docks, plastic shields to protect from dings, boxes and satchels sold to them all in endless variations. Cell phone safety accessories will be an all-new category of revenue for this business venture. If this bill passes, there will be ear cuffs that slide over the phone in every color and comfort level for those who like the 1 inch away from the head option. There will be pouches and boxes to block EMF energy bleed. There'll be dings and dent shields that will wrap 360 instead of 180, but with silver meshing. We will finally get fast kill switches for facile on-off switch functions. We'll get sleep modes with every 5 minute wake-ups. We'll get timers for data checks, storage queues, and memory for auto-sending, and every other thing consumers can come up with for personal customization of cell phone accessory safety products. Oregon's idle electronics manufacturing shops clustering around Silicon Forest giants in Hillsboro, Corvallis, Wilsonville, Gresham, Bend, and others are just waiting to jump onto the next trend. If this bill passes, venture capital will flow for research and development at small engineering firms, for mass marketing and manufacturing offshore, for importing, then re-exporting to everywhere else. If this bill passes, everybody wins, from that small mom-and-pop selling Skullcandy ear pods to the telecom giants themselves, who will find space in their innovations from consumer demand, like they did with car chargers. This will be despite their inclination to reject what they might call interference in their own research and development strategies. But in reality, consumers will likely be eager to add yet another $50 companion sale, a safety sale, to their renewal service contract. That increase will flow right into the financial markets, leveraging each residual income contract into a double-digit increase in the financial product service then by Wall Street institutions. Oregon has never been afraid of legislative innovation, from the bottle bill to vote by mail to solve now an international franchise. We have always been the first in trusting the legislative partnership with the constituent consumer demand dynamic. Sound business practices will win consumer hearts and minds, not regulatory protectionism that represses natural market responses to real consumer demand. This cell phone labeling bill will be yet another Oregon innovation for the rest of the states to follow. It is a win-win that everyone who supports this bill can be proud to take home to his or her constituents and supporters. It is a win-win for large and small manufacturers and retailers as well as consumers. I urge you to vote for the cell phone labeling bill. And I'd be happy to take questions about business.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask Mr. I think it's Averill.
Yes, ma'am.
A question about, you started talking about the impact on DNA and the eggs of girls as a parent of young adults who someday wants grandchildren. What you're talking about eggs, would the girls have to like hold it? I'm just trying to figure out how this impacts. You said it would impact the eggs of girls. Do they have to like hold it against their uterus or what? I'm just trying to figure this out.
No. Well, essentially, with cell phones, or if you have a pregnant woman and you have a fetus inside the body, in the womb, if the pregnant mother is talking on the cell phone or has in her purse near the baby, or you know, any time that this Wi-Fi can come in close contact with a young girl's eggs, whether she be born yet or not, it has the potential for causing permanent DNA damage.
I guess if I could follow, I guess it's the contact part that I'm a little confused about.
Well, anytime a girl's eggs are within close proximity of a cell phone or any type of wireless transmitter, they're going to be affected.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. We're now going to stand at ease for just a moment while we grab the phone. We weren't completely prepared for that, but we're working on it, and we're going to bring in Dr. David Carpenter. And is that it, or does Liz Boris also want to testify by phone?
Barris.
Oh, that's you. Oh, okay, my apologies. Why don't you come up while we're working on the phones? Liz, would you like?
Sure.
And could you identify yourself for the record,
yeah,
please?
My name is Elizabeth Barris, and I'm from American Association for Cell Phone Safety, and we are a national group of cell phone safety advocates. We've all been adversely affected by our own cell phone use. I have a tumor. I have really horrible problems in my head where I used my cell phone. Many of us are brain cancer victims from cell phone use, and so that's who I am. So I would like to first ask the committee, we were just told about these hearings literally a few days ago. They were confirmed, and our expert witness testimony and our packets didn't have time to reach the committee. And I have, you know, these are gorgeous pictures of DNA damage from cell phone, 2 hours of cell phone exposure. This one, rat brain before and after cell phone exposure, 2 hours. I have a picture of a glioma. This is the type of tumor that people get from their cell phones. It's a glioblastoma. And basically we have beautiful written testimony that in all fairness we would really like to have the committee look at, because I'm sure the industry has been able to get their written testimony to you in a timely manner, and we haven't had that opportunity. So perhaps if the chair, Senator Shields, would, and the committee might so be so gracious and kind as to perhaps consider having a work session vote next week so that the committee might have time to look at our written material as well as just hear our oral material. So.
Yeah, I think we've gotten quite a bit of written material as part of our record, so we will be sure to consider that.
Okay, I've got.
And you're more than welcome to give any additional.
But you guys don't have time. If you vote right now, you don't have time to look at it, right?
Well, we'll see if we end up voting on it today or not.
Okay. Basically, I'm going to. I'd sort of like to answer. You know, I think. I'm just wondering, I mean, because we do now have Motorola language talking about neural epithelial tumors, which are a deadly form of brain cancer. And by the way, I'd like to answer your question, Senator Bonamici, about the eggs and stuff. And the warnings in the Motorola manual say children should keep the phones away from their lower abdomen. That means reproductive organs. Now, they also talk about neural epithelial tumors. They also talk about structural damage to genetic material. None of that would be in their manuals right now if they did not have hard evidence to put that language in there. That is incredibly strong language. And how the cell phone would affect a woman's ovaries is if they're dialing, let's say the little girl is holding the phone here, okay, and she's dialing, the transmission, we don't know where that cell tower is. It could be behind her. It could be, who knows, it could be near her friend who's standing right next to her. But they don't know if it's one transmission or 1,000 transmission that changes the structure of the DNA. They just don't know. But they know it changes. So that's one of the reasons. And, of course, with fetuses, it's very horrific because the child is already in development. At least with sperm, the sperm could die because it becomes so deformed and the egg will not accept it. But once you have an actual fetus, that fetus is going to be born. And birth defects are another side effect from cell phone use. So I just wonder what it would take to actually put something on the phone. I mean, we have the stuff in the Motorola manuals talking about brain cancer. Structural damage to genetic, it can't get more serious than where it's at right now. Every single manufacturer, there's not one manufacturer that does not say, keep the phone approximately an inch away from the head. None of them agree, however, on exactly how far. It's approximately an inch. They're all different. They're all over the board with it. But they all share that one common denominator. Yet, they hide it in the manual. It's in fine print, just like the mortgage crisis, where it brought America down because nobody could read the fine print. Our whole country suffered because of this. Our whole country is going to be suffering because of the allowance of this crime against the American people, you know, having this stuff in the fine print where nobody can read it. Parents buy cell phones to keep their children safer. They give it to their kids to keep them safer. I think that any parent would like to know if they're giving their child a cell phone to keep them safer. All you have to do is very simple. We love cell phones. Listen, I had problems with my own cell phone use from my head. I loved my cell phone so much I continued to use it. I loved my cell phone. I use it on speakerphone in my hand. Guess what? I have an enormous tumor in my hand right where the antenna of the phone is. And by the way, the manuals say keep away. There's so much contradictory information. The manual says keep it away, the antenna away from you. Well, guess what? Every cell phone that's on the market today, you don't know where the antenna is. It's hidden. You know, even if you want to keep it away from you, you can't. It's wrapped in the housing of the phone. I called Motorola and I said, hey guys, where's my antenna? I've got a tumor in my hand. I'm kind of curious. I didn't say I had a tumor, but I just wanted to see what they'd say. They didn't know. I had to speak to three levels of people, supervisors. Finally, we get somebody on the phone that looks, does a lot of research, and they come up with, okay, the antenna is wrapped in the housing of the phone on the back of the phone. And that's all they could tell me. They said it might be near the battery. Well, that's exactly where my tumor is. So anyway, so bottom line, I'm just wondering what exactly would it take to put some kind of warning. Just, and this thing, by the way, we're not asking you guys to weigh the science. We don't want anyone on the committee. We know you guys are not scientists. We do not expect the committee to make a judge. Industry-funded science, is that correct? Or independently funded science, is that correct? We do not want that answer from you. We are not asking you to weigh the science. We are asking you to consider, is there controversy over the science? That's it. Is there controversy? And I have a statement from the FCC's website that shows they pulled this statement. They're now being investigated. They're blocking people from getting. We have a Freedom of Information Act going. We want to know how close they've been working with CTIA on this issue. So the FCC website actually said to keep.
Listen, when you get done with this, I want to make sure that we can
In
with the
okay,
doctor and that the opponents have a fair chance.
Absolutely.
Because we're going to have to wrap up at 3:15.
Some parties assert that any potential health risks are probably greater for children than adults. Finally, some experts think that low-frequency magnetic fields, rather than RF energy measured by SAR, possibly are responsible for any potential health risk associated with wireless devices.
the precautions are. And then they tell people, keep the phone off, keep it away from your head and your body. All this information was pulled from the FCC website, and they now say, we don't condone any precautions. There is a cover-up going on of this information. And it's at the expense of Oregonians. It's at the expense of Americans. So we're not asking the committee to weigh the science. We're asking, is there controversy? And we have these warnings in every single phone manual. Keep it away from the head and the body. It's buried and it's hidden. All we're saying is, please, put it on the phone. I think people should be spared the kind of agony that I have been through from my own cell phone use. And children are now coming down with brain tumors, and the industry is going to tell you, oh, there's no rise in the brain tumor registry. Oh, there's no increase in cancer. Well, they full well know cancer is a 30-year latency time before it shows up. 30 years. People sometimes get it at 10 years, but that's not normal. But they do.
Liz, yes. I'm going to have to cut you off. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
We need David Kaufman. That's it. Okay.
Dr. Carpenter's office, this is Chris.
Chris, hi. This is State Senator Chip Shields calling from Oregon. You are live in the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee. Is Dr. Carpenter available for testimony, please?
Yes, just a moment.
Hopefully our phones were better than ours.
Yeah. Yeah, I got it first try this time. Mm-hmm.
But they're transferring.
Hello?
Hello, Dr. Carpenter.
Yes.
You are live in the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee. We are discussing Senate Bill 679. We would appreciate your testimony. I do want to make sure that the opponents have a fair chance to present their side of this bill, so anything you can do to keep your comments concise would be much appreciated. But take it away.
I understand I'm supposed to say my piece in 3 minutes, is that correct?
We'll give you a little latitude, but if you can do it in three, you would be my hero.
I'll do it as quickly as I can.
All right.
I think the evidence, I know the evidence, that there is an elevated risk of brain cancer from extensive use, long-term extensive use of cell phones, is very convincing at this point. There still are some unanswered questions, of course. But there have been a number of studies and several what we call meta-analyses, where scientists have taken reports from many different investigators, in one case 33 epidemiological studies, that have asked the question, does long-term cell phone use increase the risk of brain cancer? These studies conclusively show that, yes, it does. But the risk is only obvious in people that have used cell phones on a regular basis for more than 10 years and is much greater on the side of the head where people traditionally use their cell phones than on the other side of the head. Now, the studies that have been done in the U.S. have been uniformly negative, but that is because we in the U.S. have not used cell phones for all that long. And none of the studies that have been done here have controlled for the length of time that persons have been talking on cell phones. The studies in Sweden, where actually cell phones were originally invented in Finland, so Scandinavians have used them longer than anybody else. And the strongest evidence of this relationship comes from Scandinavia. One very concerning thing is, now it's only been a single study, not the 33 that I mentioned earlier, but a study from Sweden has demonstrated that individuals that begin to use a cell phone regularly under the age of 20 have about a fourfold greater risk of developing brain cancer than an adult. And furthermore, that the brain cancer risk, the brain cancers increase at a shorter latency. Normally for environmental exposures, the latency between exposure and developing the cancer is viewed as being somewhere between 10 and 30 years. A study in the children demonstrated elevated cancer in children that had used cell phones only for 1 year. Now, the good news there, as far as our contemporary society is concerned, is that most of the kids are texting now and holding the cell phone away from their head, which would reduce their exposure significantly. Now, the problem is not just brain cancer, although from my judgment as a public health physician, that's the health effect of greatest concern, because that obviously in many cases is a fatal, and even if not fatal, is a very dangerous and disruptive cancer. But there are other studies that demonstrate clearly that long-term use of radiofrequency radiation, especially men wearing their cell phone in their belt, causes reduction in sperm count, decreases fertility. There is a very important study from the National Institutes of Health that appeared just a month ago that investigators measured the metabolism of the brain, looking, nerve cells use glucose as their food, and this was a measure using modern imaging techniques that demonstrated that use of a cell phone, even when the sound was muted, increased the metabolism of glucose in the part of the brain closest to the ear. Now, in the U.S., our standards for regulation of safety of cell phones are based on the assumption that there are no adverse effects of radiofrequency radiation at intensities that do not cause measurable heating. And therefore, there's a sense that there are no non-thermal effects that are of concern. That clearly is not the case, as the studies that I've mentioned and many other studies have demonstrated. So we do have a problem with national and international standards on safety of cell phones. I don't mean to say that there aren't still some questions, because there are. We're not absolutely certain of the mechanisms whereby using a cell phone leads to cancer. We have some pretty good ideas on how it leads to low sperm counts, because these radio frequency radiations generate free radicals, or we call them reactive oxygen species. But the evidence of harm is sufficiently strong that a warning, not a rigid regulation, but a warning to allow the consumers to understand that there is a strong possibility of adverse health effects, especially with extensive and intensive use of cell phones. A warning would help consumers to be aware. We're not going to go back to a pre-wireless age, and no one is advocating that. But there are ways in which one can use wireless technology in fashions that do not increase exposure to the brain or the pelvis or other body organs.
Dr. Carpenter.
And a warning would help to alert the public to that.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Carpenter. And could you just briefly explain your credentials as well?
Yes, I'm a medical doctor. I graduated from Harvard Medical School. I'm not a medical practitioner. I'm the former dean of the School of Public Health at the University of Albany. I worked for the New York State Department of Health for many years, and in the 1980s administered the New York State Power Lines Project, which was a state initiative to determine whether there were health hazards from high-voltage power lines. And since then, I've been involved in a variety of issues related to electromagnetic fields.
Thank you, Dr. Carpenter. We appreciate your testimony, and I apologize that we have such a crowded agenda, but I'm
I understand.
I'm
no
have,
problem.
I have to let you go there. Thank you very much again
for taking the time to testify.
All right.
Goodbye.
Thank you. Can we bring up now in opposition of panel Howard Ori, Jerry Keegan, and Michael Bagley?
Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Howard Ori, and I'm pleased to be here today. I'm the former Deputy Director for Epidemiology at the Centers for Disease Control. I've published more than 100 scientific articles. I've consulted for public health agencies such as the World Health Organization and the Food and Drug Administration. I also happen to live here in Oregon 4 months of the year. My daughter and her family also live here. I'm here on behalf of the wireless industry to address the proposed Bill 679, which I believe to be ill-conceived and should not be passed. Its premise is that controversy exists over whether alleged unspecific non-thermal effects of exposure to RF emissions from cell phones pose a threat of harm to humans. There is no legitimate controversy over the state of science in this area. Studies to date do not demonstrate a causal association between cell phones and cancer or other harms to humans. Government agencies throughout the world charged with regularly reviewing these data agree. In particular, the World Health Organization, WHO, has stated, quote, a large number of studies have been performed over the last two decades to assess whether mobile phones pose a potential health risk. To date, no adverse health effects have been established for mobile phone use. And they specifically go on to say further in that paragraph that this includes levels below those that cause tissue heating. In other words, non-thermal effects. The National Cancer Institute, FDA, and FCC have issued concurring statements. In the face of evidence to the contrary, the discussion of an alleged controversy about potential harm of alleged non-thermal effects of RF emissions misleads consumers. But most egregiously, SB 679 would require labels that refer to cell phones as RF radiation-emitting devices. The use of the term radiation in this context is extremely misleading. Given the recent tragic disaster in Japan, for a long time to come, the word radiation will be synonymous with the harmful ionizing radiation associated with nuclear reactors and atomic bombs, the carcinogenic stuff leaking from damaged nuclear power plants. To the contrary, cell phones emit non-ionizing radiation, electromagnetic energy, which is not a known carcinogen and is ubiquitous in everyday life, emitted from TVs, radios, computers, among other things. SB 679 radically departs from the FCC's measured advice to consumers by providing an alarmist, incorrect, and misleading warning against exposure to RF radiation from radiation-emitting devices. Let's look at the scientific data on brain cancer and cell phones. If, as some people speculate, wireless phone use causes brain cancer, then we would expect to see this increase in the incidence of brain cancer coincident with the use of wireless phones. We've not seen any such increase. And also, I will provide a written statement, but also because of the short notice, I didn't have it. This is the National Cancer Institute's recent...
I'm sorry, we're not going to be able to hear you for the record, and this is all recorded.
Okay.
You can email that to the...
Well,
to
we can hand it around. And
bring
it
yeah.
This is the graph of... the top graph is the increase in cell phones from 1987 to the present. The bottom graph shows the incidence rate of brain tumors. And this is published by the National Cancer Institute. It's obvious, I believe, to a layperson that there is no association between the rapid rise in cell phone use and the absolutely flat incidence of brain cancer. And the National Cancer Institute concludes, overall, these incidence data from the United States based on high-quality cancer registries do not provide support for the view that the use of cell phones causes brain cancer. Despite the lack of any known mechanism by which wireless phones could cause cancer, this issue has been studied scientifically for years in animals and people. A combined analysis of all existing human epidemiologic studies of wireless phone use and tumor risk concludes that there was no overall association between wireless phone use and brain cancer, and this result was true even in people who had used the phone for more than 10 years. Scientists have conducted multiple studies exposing animals to high-dose RF for the life of the animals. Overwhelmingly, these studies do not report any consistent association between wireless phone exposure and cancer or other harms, even under extreme exposure conditions. These animal studies, the mother was exposed while she was carrying the fetuses. The fetuses were born, followed for their entire life, and in some cases, multiple generations. I think it speaks directly to the question of whether women's ovaries are damaged. And these are animals exposed 24 hours a day. Let me conclude. The scientific evidence does not support Senate Bill 679. There is no consistent evidence of adverse health effects from exposure to RF fields at levels below those that cause tissue heating. There is no consistent risk of brain cancer in the epidemiologic and animal studies. Brain cancer incidence has remained the same since wireless phone use has become common. There is no known mechanism by which non-ionizing radiation from wireless phones could cause cancer. All of these findings apply equally to pregnant women and children. As a former public health official, I firmly believe that labeling requirements must be grounded in scientific fact. SB 679 is not. I am genuinely concerned that this bill will lead to consumers being misled. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the committee. Chairman Shields, members of the committee, Jerry Keegan with CTI, the Wireless Association, in opposition to Senate Bill 679. In 1996, the FCC, after careful consultation with the FDA, EPA, and OSHA, adopted standards governing radio frequency energy from cell phones. The FCC asserted that its standards represent, quote, the best scientific thought and are sufficient to protect the public health. Unquote. No wireless device may be sold or marketed in this country without FCC authorization. As part of its standards, the FCC issued a maximum RF exposure limit based on a specific absorption rate of 1.6 watts per kilogram. The FCC states that, quote, any cell phone at or below these SAR levels, that is, any phone legally sold in the U.S. is a safe phone as measured by these standards, unquote. The FCC shares regulatory responsibilities for cell phones with the FDA. The FCC certifies wireless devices and relies on the FDA and other health agencies on health-related questions about cell phones. The FCC has expressly evaluated the potential thermal and non-thermal effects, biological effects of RF energy from FCC-licensed devices. In fact, the FCC, in its 1997 RF order, addressed a series of proposals calling for lower RF exposure limits than those originally adopted by it, based on the alleged non-thermal effects of RF emissions, and specifically declined to adopt those proposals. The FCC's decision not to change its RF exposure limits based on alleged non-thermal effects has been upheld repeatedly by federal courts on appeal. In the Cellular Phone Task Force case, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals specifically rejected the argument that the FCC standards did not account for non-thermal effects. In the EMR network case, the D.C. Circuit upheld the FCC's decision not to initiate a proceeding to revise its RF regulations. In fact, the D.C. Circuit found, quote, nothing in the studies referenced by the petitioners that would have required the FCC to revisit its rules. Leading national and international health and safety organizations, including the FDA, the National Cancer Institute, and the World Health Organization, have concluded that there are no known adverse health effects associated with the use of wireless devices. The FDA concludes that, quote, the scientific evidence does not show a danger to any users of cell phones from RF exposure, including children and teenagers, unquote. And that statement is less than 2 years old. The statement that Dr. Ori mentioned from the World Health Organization was just released March 2010. These statements are not outdated. Any labeling mandate on cell phones would act as a consumer product warning. when the Maine legislature voted down a similar cell phone warning labeling bill last year. Dr. Dora Ann Mills, the director of the state CDC, summarized it best when she testified in opposition to that bill and said, quote, "To warn against something, there should be a defined risk. Our reading of the research, including numerous studies and analyses, does not indicate there is a defined cancer risk to warn against," unquote. Moreover, Dr. Mills found that issuing warnings based on undefined risks would result in a, quote, "overwarned and turned off public, as well as a lack of credibility in the warnings themselves." As the Maine CDC found, mandating cell phone labeling is unnecessary and would result in consumers doubting the efficacy of warning labeling generally, thereby lessening the impact of labels on other consumer products where they serve to protect consumers from defined risks and true harm. In closing, Senate Bill 679 is unnecessary. It ignores the conclusions of leading international and national health organizations on this subject and conflicts with federal law on this topic. Thank you, Chairman.
Welcome to the committee.
Chairman Shields, members of the committee, my name is Michael Bagley. I am the Executive Director for Public Policy for the West for Verizon Wireless. I appreciate the opportunity to briefly testify in opposition to SB 679, legislation addressing labeling wireless handsets for specific absorption rates. We believe the proposed legislation is unnecessary and is bad for both consumers and businesses operating in the great state of Oregon. The legislation is unnecessary and would have the effect of scaring the public for no reason. The health effects issue relative to wireless handsets has already been studied fully at the federal level by qualified institutions. It's a federal issue and should be remain at the federal level and not be left to state-by-state interpretations of science. The FCC already occupies the field on this issue and sets minimum exposure levels for handsets. Specifically, the FCC sets a minimum standard of 1.6 standard for SAR values, and all handsets sold to the public fall well below this threshold. Therefore, knowing the SAR value on a handset, which already meets the standards set by the FCC, adds nothing of value to the consumer's understanding of the product, and there are no issues of safety. Even though the SAR number alone doesn't tell the whole story, because the because proximity to cell sites and strength of signal have to be considered. The bottom line is that the FCC already addresses a safety issue. SB 679 would require carriers to put a warning to say that, quote unquote, controversy exists as whether these effects are harmful to humans. Controversy does not exist in this regard. Studies by all reputable scientific institutions, such as the Centers for Disease Control and the FCC, have found no evidence of any harm. We therefore believe that the bill raises constitutional issues with the First Amendment to try to compel carriers to make labeling warnings that we believe are not accurate, and this would serve to scare the public for no reason. The bill makes wrong assumptions and takes matters out of context. Such requirements put the state at risk, as well as for potentially costly litigation with regard to the First Amendment and with regard to federal preemption. This committee has part of its title, Small Business Protection. SB 679 is a disincentive for all businesses, large and small, to operate, locate, or expand their operations in Oregon. There will be costs for compliance that will take resources away from carriers that ought to go into the kinds of things that consumers really want to see investments in to support their cellular service, new stores and kiosks, more staff to reduce in-store wait times, new devices and additional cell sites. The bill's burdensome mandates would add unnecessary costs to prevent information that is misleading in context to address a matter that is already addressed fully at the federal level. Verizon Wireless is proud to do business in Oregon. We have over 1 million customers in this state and over 20 retail locations. We're proud of our network investments here, but equally bad, this bill would help create confusion in our stores. It's not good to have young store employees put a situation that whether they're asked to explain the science of RF and specific absorption rates. This is confusing for both the workers and the customers and unnecessary since the handsets pose no risk to meet the prescribed safety standards. I would also add that if you go to Verizon Wireless's website, you can get information on SARS. We help direct our customers to the FCC. To the issue that was earlier raised about education, there are lots of opportunities for educating the public on this. We think the education is the way to go, but the credible institutions that are set up to look at this have looked at it, and they've not drawn conclusions that there is an issue here, and it's unfair to pass a bill to scare the public unnecessarily. So we urge a no vote on SB 679. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Bagley. Thank Senator Bonamici.
Thank you. I don't know if you, I think you were here for the earlier testimony, and you heard that Motorola has a warning in their package. Do you disagree with that? And if not, if it's in the package, do you have any comment about why Motorola would put a warning in their package?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the statement that is in the package is not a warning statement. It's a statement of compliance. If you go to the Office of Engineering and Technology, Bulletin 65, Supplement C, page 41.
You have that memorized.
Yes. You will find the language that the FCC recommends that manufacturers put into their manuals in order to reflect the appropriate testing protocol that the FCC mandates for the device.
And Mr. Chair, if I could ask a brief follow-up, I know we're almost out of time. And so do other carriers have that same language in their...
Well, let's separate carriers from manufacturers. Motorola makes the phones. So Verizon, well, we don't make the phones, we buy them. But when you buy a Motorola handset, a HTC or any other from Verizon Wireless, when you open the box, there's information in there. So it's misleading to say that's a warning that there's a health threat. No, it's not. It's information about SARS. It's also information about driving responsibly. And then it also tells you where to go to get more information. So we make it available for consumers to get the information, and it's in the boxes when you open the handset. All carriers have that in the boxes they sell.
Of a Motorola phone?
Of all handsets. If it's a BlackBerry, RIM, or Apple, or whoever.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much for your testimony, gentlemen. Jim Craven.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Jim Craven, representing Tech America, the National Trade Association for the High-Tech Industry. I'm not going to belabor the points, I guess, to say, but we would agree with the previous panel in opposing the bill for the reasons that were stated. Mainly, we tend to be fairly skeptical about state-by-state labeling of devices, particularly in an area where we don't think that it's warranted. Among my members include a lot of people in this space, from chip makers such as TriQuint and Hillsborough, who makes chips that go into cell phones. We have software manufacturers such as Microsoft that makes software that runs cell phones. We include phone device manufacturers such as Motorola and Apple among our membership, and we have at least one carrier, Verizon. So a position from our National Trade Association on the bill, and we'd urge you to not move forward with it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Jim, any questions? All right. So we're in a public hearing. I think what I'd like to do is just make a couple of comments. Some people who are involved in the industry send me an email saying, why are you even wasting the legislature's time on this? And I just want to explain why I decided to hold a hearing on this. You know, we get about 3,000 bills every session, and probably 2,900 of those are from a corporate interest group, a union, or a government agency. And I think that it's important that just everyday people who have an idea and would like a fair vetting of it in front of the legislature have their chance to present their argument and for us to hear it. I do think that this was a good first step for you all coming forward. My sense of the body is that you need to educate more of the legislators in order to be able to move this through this chamber and then through the second chamber. But I do appreciate you bringing it forward. I've been involved in bills that I'm still working on into my fourth session that I haven't been able to get passed. So I just want to let you know how much I appreciate the time that you put into this. And the opponents, I appreciate you bringing your testimony here. That's what the legislature is here for, is to air ideas and to see which ideas can gain the Democratic support in order to pass. So I wish you well in the future on this topic. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 679. And just to put on the record, colleagues, we will be rolling over 717, 718, 719, 573, 634, 612, 667, 890, 944, and 908. Patrick, did I get every one of them? All right. Then I will close this meeting.